Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So the Media Project is underway once again with the music of Pete Seeger, which we always think is the best part of the show, so you get to hear a little bit more of that at the end.
Neat.
Something to look forward to, and we're just the sandwich in between the fine pieces of bread.
Huh.
Something like that.
Interesting.
Alan Shartok, Rosemary Armeo, and Rex Smith here. We are the Media Project. Dr. Shartok is the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Rosemary Armeo, longtime investigative journalist and professor at the University of Albany. And I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. Here we are.
But wait.
Last
week you said I wouldn't be here for a long time because I was having back surgery.
I'm
here I am.
Here you are.
Here I am.
He wouldn't leave us alone for even a week.
No, he doesn't trust us. No.
Here I am.
It'd get boring.
Well, it's miraculous,
that,
Alan.
It is.
I congratulate you.
Yes.
And he's upright, too.
Don't congratulate me. Congratulate the surgeon.
Okay.
Dr. Shen. He's wonderful.
That's a wonderful thing. Well, we're glad that you're back.
Are you really glad? Are you sure you're glad?
We're going to talk here about how journalists go about verifying information and why they do. There's this new study, very small study, only 28 Canadian journalists, but they were really great award-winning journalists. And they were studied for a paper that ended up with an interesting title, Verification as a Strategic Ritual. I like that notion, that verification is a strategic ritual of journalism. And interestingly, the researchers found that there isn't really a standard practice of verification, but it is so fundamental to journalism that it makes you wonder why there's not.
This is, in fact, the first study that they've ever done on the process, the journalistic process. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what they found is that it isn't done very well on checking personal histories, for example. The researchers found that mostly the journalists don't question someone's personal history. They assume you're telling the truth about yourself. We've been caught a number of times. We've talked about it on the show when that has proved not to be the case.
There are two verification issues, it seems to me. One is, does the reporter verify? And number two is, who watches the reporter,
right,
in terms of verification?
You know, in daily journalism, in newspapers, television, radio, there isn't really the time to do the kind of fact-checking that magazines do. If you write something for The New Yorker, say, or for even a much lesser publication than that, somebody goes over line by line with the reporter. How did you get that? Let me see your source for that. Even let me see your notes, which is a remarkable thing that we don't do as editors.
Investigative reporting we have done, and you do it also on your big projects, ones where you're worried about a lawsuit especially.
That's right.
You do what we call an audit, where you check off every discrete fact in a story has to be backed by a document or a named source.
So why, guys, why is it done in the magazines but not the newspapers?
Well, they have time. That is really it. We have deadlines that are constant, you know.
Yeah.
But as Rosemary says, when we have time and we have a big project, we did a project that was published at the beginning of 2012 that took us a year to do. And that took so long in part because of exactly that. The lawyers were asking for every detail.
What was the project?
This had to do with the group called NXIVM, which is identified as a self-help operation based here in the Capital Region, and we did a major four-part series looking into it. A charismatic leader of the group called Keith Raniere. We thought that there were some interesting issues, and for more of that, I refer you to the story itself, because I'm not going to say anything aloud for that very reason. The words that we use were very carefully lawyered,
selected,
as we say. We turn that into a verb.
You know, I think there's one other reason that there's so little done to kind of systematize verification, and that's that it wasn't really important until kind of recently. In our business in the 19th century and much of the 20th, it was okay to pad it a little, to add a little bit more. When I went to journalism school, I teach there now, I certainly don't teach this, but when I went to journalism school, we were taught on a quote, to get the essence. That was all that was important, not the exact words. And of course, that's a sea change that we have been through now. Mm-hmm. That now, no, the exact words are important. And I noticed in the study that checking for quotes is also very variable. Some reporters check, they go back against a tape, others don't.
I never used to use, when I first became a political reporter covering Governor Cuomo, the first Governor Cuomo, that I started using a tape recorder. Most of us were taught not to at the outset. Well, tape recorders didn't used to be as compact. Now I think every reporter in the state capitol is using these little digital recorders. It's just the way, so the practice has changed. Offering sources an opportunity to review particular elements of content never used to be done.
Yeah.
We're doing more of that these days.
So in other words, you take the recorder and say, yes, you did say that. Here it is.
Yeah. But even going back and then saying, here's what I'm reporting, going back to the source who gave you the information and saying, you tell me if there's anything wrong in this. We never would have done that 20 years ago. And now we're doing it more, especially on technical stuff, because we're covering stuff, I think, in part, that's more complex than we used to.
Yeah, there's more of a view now that if somebody is going to complain, better to have them complain to you before you put it out than afterward.
Then why not just send them the story?
Well,
here's the thing. It's psychological. If you send an entire story, especially if it's on paper, then you sit down, as I do, as you're doing, with a pen in hand, and you go through and you mark up a whole lot. That's the last thing you want done. You don't need another editor.
No, you don't want it.
No, you don't want it.
You don't
want
to give them the opportunity. On the other hand, you know, I was talking to my class the other day, the Legislative Gazette class in Albany, and I was talking
to them. Just to explain, these are college students who are reporters for a weekly publication that you put out.
They spend their last semester, usually, covering the legislature for this newspaper under a professional journalist, in this case, a man named Jamie Gormley, who's very good.
It's a wonderful project, a great practicum for college students.
Well, thank you, Rex. I really appreciate that.
I said my best students there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, in any case, I was talking about what they learn in Journalism 101 compared with what one learns to do in terms of getting stuff. So, for example, and you guys may not like what I'm talking about here, but there's a certain amount of trading that goes on. If somebody is perceived as a fair reporter, or somebody is perceived as somebody who you could go to and say, I got a story here I think is really good, and I think you might want to use it. In other words, there's not an official quid pro quo, but, you know, there are some reporters you get along with and some you don't get along with, and some you help and some you don't. I say that is the sort of education that goes on post-journalism education.
Sure. Yeah, that's definitely true. And one of the key things that you learn, the phrase that came to me when I was a young reporter was, I learned how to point up a story. That was, my editors taught me how not to just take a mass of information and put it there, but how to give a particular direction to a story so that readers could more quickly understand what point you were trying to make. That isn't the same thing. It's a fine line between that and writing a story that is biased. But if your job is to give people a true picture of what's true, of what's accurate, then it doesn't just mean Joe said this. We've talked about this in the show before.
Sure.
Mary said this, but it really is to point up the story in a certain direction. And that's something that's hard to learn, that takes a little bit of professional practice.
Have either of you looked at the Time Magazine cover story this week? It's extraordinary, by Stephen Brill. It's a 26,000-word thesis on why healthcare costs are so high. And talk about putting a mass of material with a lot of bias on both sides on. He frames it around the idea about, you know, we've been debating for years now and who ought to be paying these bills. I'm going to look here at why are the bills so high?
Yeah.
It's a great idea, pointing it in the right direction and, you know, amassing huge amounts of material. Highly recommend it.
Very useful. Yes, I've read reviews of it. Really useful journalism.
It's
high
great.
Impact, long-form journalism.
But I was going to ask you guys about this. When you look at the idea, as Rex just said, you're pointing up a story, right? You're pointing up a story. And one man's truth is another man's poison, right? Or woman's poison.
Could be.
In other words, you say, let's say you're doing guns. and you want to point up the story. That's going to bring them out all right, one way or the other. And they're going to be convinced that you're lying, that you're hopelessly compromised by pointing up the story in one way.
Well, people are going to be are going to believe that you're biased if you don't report what they believe to be true regardless. And there's been research showing that the more facts you bring to marshal against a person's point of view, the more you reinforce for them their viewpoint that is contrary to the facts.
I absolutely believe that.
You know,
there's an interesting story this week that we looked at about the FBI investigating threats against a professor. And this happened after the New York Times quoted him about that whole gun map issue at the Westchester paper.
Which we have talked
a lot, right? Yeah. Well, apparently this professor is getting calls with gunshots in the background.
Really?
And yeah. So
time to change your number.
It's a frightening thing that even just giving your opinion, and as the professor says, he talked to this guy for 10 minutes. 99% of what he said wasn't even in the article. There's
right.
one or two little quotes, and from this, he's getting serious threats. So it's really hard to give a balanced, cover all the points of view perspective in a piece anymore.
When people are verbally assaulted with threats of physical assault by their readers for even just asking
right.
a question. Now,
right.
this happened at a weekly paper in North Carolina, in Murphy, North Carolina, a little paper called the Cherokee Scout. The editor of the paper asked the sheriff for the data on who in the county had concealed carry permits, who was allowed to carry a gun and concealed. And for simply asking the question, the reporter was getting, I guess it was called the editor of this little paper, was getting threats, ended up having to resign. There was a front page apology published by the publisher, and this guy is leaving town. His wife is a local school teacher.
Shame on that publisher.
Absolutely.
He said the sheriff who had denied the request had the best interests of the people of the county at heart by denying a request for public information.
Lovely.
Horrible.
That's outrageous. You know, that's the kind of a publisher who ought to be sued for malpractice, you know,
yep.
but I don't know what, you can't really do that. He's the, you know, you own the paper.
I mean, I refer him to the Constitution. If the officials took care of the people, then you wouldn't need a press.
I untypically agree with both of you.
Untypically. Enough of this serious stuff. We need to
take the other side on this one.
It's not so interesting when you agree with us.
What about star appeal? Okay, let's talk about television a little bit. Soledad O'Brien is losing her job on CNN. Why do we care about this?
I care because I like her.
I care because I never liked her. I thought she was a piece of fluff. I used her coverage of the tsunami in Japan a couple of years ago as an example of horrible TV reporting. And then in the past year, something has happened. I think it's this morning show. And she has become an actual reporter. She has asked aggressive, hard-hitting, although respectfully put, follow-up questions. She has been a real force. She's become a true broadcast journalist in the Edward Murrow tradition, and now she's out, just as CNN has cut back on its investigative reporting team. What is going on at CNN?
Well, Jeff Zucker, the former president of NBC Universal, is now taking over CNN, and so he is probably giving it more of a star appeal, right? He's hired
Chris Cuomo
and Aaron Burnett.
Who looks just like the brother. Looks just like the governor.
Well, I think he looks a little better than the governor.
No, he does look a little bit better. And he certainly speaks a little bit better.
Have you watched him, though?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think he's much better than the brother.
But the brother's not a broadcaster or a journalist. How do you think of him
as a
journalist?
No, but the brother has to communicate with the people. And when you communicate in a Queens accent as opposed to what?
This is not talking about somebody's accent here. Well, I guess for a TV anchor, you would be. But you shouldn't care about a politician's accent, should you?
Well, if the guy wants to be president of the United States, and how does it play in Kansas, I think you ought to worry about it.
Well, you'd worry about it from a political standpoint.
I wrote a column about it saying he ought to have the same guy who did The King's English. Remember the film The King's English?
Yeah.
Ought to have that guy, you know, helping him out a little bit.
Well, that guy's probably older than you are at this point, Alan.
King's dead.
Where were we here? Anyway, I like Soledad O'Brien because she's been a great advocate of news literacy. She believes in and has been a great supporter of the notion of training high school students in particular, in her case, to understand...
That they have to read a newspaper.
About verification. Well, not that they have to read a newspaper, but to understand what journalism is, what we were talking about, the process of verification and how that's different from propaganda, public relations, advertising, raw data, all of which has its place. But she's been a real leader in that.
But the upshot of it is, Rex, that they fire her.
Yeah.
Now, what I loved about her is how she handled it. Instead of saying, you know, oh, woe is me, or they're a bunch of rats, or even implying that, she said it's a win-win. The station really wasn't supporting me the way they I look at the incredulity on both of Rosemary and Rex's face. They're saying, this guy actually read this article.
it is rare.
Yeah.
It is rare.
So no, but she handled it with such grace, which was, instead of blaming anybody, said, well, it's good for me because they weren't helping me the way they ought to have been helping me at the station. They weren't putting the resources into it. And so now I'm sort of free to
know.
Having
been fired and tried to handle it with grace, I'm now in favor of throwing chairs at the person who fires you and yelling about it. I don't see that this... She should be saying, what's happening to Hard News? She should be an advocate for it.
So you're critical.
I'm critical of that. I think that it is a big loss. Let me say that. And Erin Burnett, it graduated from Williams College. She has some local ties. I've been following her for a while.
She's
a
new one.
She has a lot of potential, but mostly she's on TV because she's beautiful, not because she's a great analyst.
Well, wait a second. What's wrong with being beautiful?
I mean, you want to count somebody out? Cuomo and Erin Burnett are there because of looks and power, not because they're doing good journalism.
You don't know. Well, okay, you do know this. Okay, you do know this. That's fair.
That's my criticism.
Nevertheless,
personal opinion.
You put Jeff Zucker in and you find that CNN is running third and you say, okay, what is it that will make this thing go? And he knows. Look, he's not sitting next to Rosemary and saying, Professor, we should be doing all of these intellectual things. He's saying, this is what works. They're going to put her in a short skirt. They're going to put her up there. They're going to do what they have to do. Yeah. It's disgusting.
Yeah,
I completely agree with you. There's no question
you're right. It probably will be commercially a good thing, but I don't have to like it, and I do not like it.
As a very smart publisher once said to me, no money, no mission. Basically, if you don't get the revenue, you're not able to fulfill your
mission.
Or
no church, no listeners, nobody hears it.
Okay, so we've done that in the morning shows, too. There's been this big rush to be number one. And is there a morning show worth listening to in
NPR.
The morning now? No. So there's money, but there's no mission.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah, there, and that is always the point of conflict where you don't know where you're going to end up.
Well, what kind of mission do you want, Rosemary?
I take great
exception to this.
Oh, it's all fluff and how to cook and celebrities, and don't we have enough of that?
Well, people have to know how to eat.
So I guess that Alan is taking a rather negative point of view. I think you're right, though.
There's no comeback for that.
So tune in to NPR, which has some wonderful reporting. I was so struck by a report that I heard from Kenya, from a reporter on the ground in Kenya, talking about the corruption of the campaign for the presidency and for Congress there. I know a fellow who's running for Congress in Kenya, and it is it must be a terrifying process, but it is open to the highest bidder, basically.
Nothing of what happened after the last election.
Absolutely. Yeah. So these kinds of things, you have to turn to NPR, which is a not-for-profit supported by gifts from donors, people who indirectly, that is, people who give money to WAMC, and WAMC pays a lot of money to NPR, supports the journalism that we all find now really so essential.
Approaching $1 million.
Okay, so Soledad gets fired. That's going to save them a lot of money, and we're going to see like some hard investigative reporting. Oh, oops, they got rid of their investigative team.
Oops, that too. So what happens? Nielsen comes along and will say, well, yes, your ratings are up a little bit, but as the scripture says, what profiteth a man to if he gaineth the world but loseth his soul, or something like that. Thank you, King James. This is the Media Project from WAMC. I'm Rex Smith from the Times Union, Rosemary Armeo, Alan Shartok, and here we are speaking of Nielsen. Nielsen is changing the way they have been reaching conclusions about who's watching what, because it is really difficult these
days.
Now
we should say
tell,
this is the rating.
Right?
This is the way people know what their ratings are.
The ratings
are,
absolutely.
And advertising is based on it, so it's important commercially,
okay,
too.
Okay, so what are they doing, Rex?
Well, now they're trying to get beyond the fact of the books that they've always kept for so many years. And it's especially challenging because so many people now are time shifting. They're watching stuff on their computers, their iPads. They're looking at different times. They're
skipping commercials. I do all of it that
way. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So
it's fascinating how much viewing has changed and what does it mean and how much a difference it is. Like almost all of 60 Minutes is watched as it's airing. And it's not very few people, in other words, tape and watch it later. But then there's some of the Modern Family, which is pretty funny. If you look at, it's an ABC show. And if you look at it for who watches it that day or within 3 hours of the show, it ranks like number 12. Then if you stretch it out like a week, it rises to like the third watch show in the country, which of course is a big difference in its advertising.
Yes, so and by the way, really 60 Minutes gets reshown on some of the cable places, some of the stories.
True.
So then the question to me, and I ask you experts, is this. If somebody is buying advertising in the Times Union, Rex's paper, or digitally in the Times Union, will we, the consumer, be looking at the advertising and ingesting it differently? So in other words, should people pay more for advertising in the newspaper because people like me like to see, things in print? Or not?
Well, you can verify. You have a tear sheet of a newspaper. You have something right in front of you. And we have talked here before about the Audit Bureau of Circulation, which audits, which is jointly done by advertisers and by the industry, that audits the actual numbers of a newspaper. But the difficult thing in digital is you cannot measure where some of your hits are coming from. That is, if you're accessing something on a mobile site, which is what is growing astronomically,
sure,
from a mobile device, you can't tell exactly where that mobile device is. That mobile device could be here in the capital region where we're speaking from, or that mobile device could be in Cleveland. And if they're coming to timesunion.com, you can't tell where they're coming from. That's a little bit difficult.
Yes, I've often wondered when I go to a site and they say, do you mind if we monitor where you are? I always say, yes, I mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't, because I think they're just up to no good. I have no idea why they're
doing
it.
And the cell phones, there's that scary little feature that it pinpoints where you are. If you should happen to go on Facebook, it tells the world where you are. I hate that.
Get this statistic. Each week, this is this thing from Nielsen.
Yes.
This is amazing. Each week, the average American spends 32 hours and 15 minutes watching live television. Isn't that amazing? More than 12 hours is spent watching time-shifted TV or DVDs.
What does that mean, time-shifted?
You taped it and watched it later.
Yeah, okay.
The other thing I found very interesting, this is an AP article that we keep referring to, looking at TV ratings, is the idea of binge viewing, which we never used to have, and now we do. I've lost the lost weekend when all I did was watch, West Wing from beginning to end.
Absolutely.
I like took breaks to go to the bathroom and eat. That
and how
was
did
it.
You feel afterwards?
In a daze. I loved it. You totally forget
really,
all your problems.
Really? Because I get very depressed when I
really?
Do
Really? Oh, you're completely immersed in another world. It's like reading a Dickens novel. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. My teenage daughter has gotten into West Wing suddenly. And so in her mind, Jed Bartlett is the president and it's 2000. And it's quite amazing when she was just, a child when I was addicted to it. And now I get to see it all over again.
Well,
really
I love
great.
That program as long as Clinton was the president. but then afterwards, obviously, I wasn't big on the Bushes.
I actually had a terrible lump in my throat when that went off the air because the fantasy was so great that such a smart person was president.
Could be president, right?
Isn't that a great notion? Yeah.
Well, Wired is another one that we watched, beginning to end. Like we'd say, okay, we'll just watch one episode. Okay, we'll watch one more, and then the next thing you know, it's morning.
Now here's one more issue we've got to get to before this program ends because it's going too quickly, and that is there was this horrendous crash at Daytona, aside from the fact that we may say that some people watch NASCAR in the hopes of a crash. That's a cynical notion. But there was a terrible crash where parts of the car went into the crowd and a couple dozen people were injured. Here is the issue for us. NASCAR is attempting to have a fan video removed from YouTube, claiming that nobody has a right to own and use video taken at one of their races. Isn't that a violation of the First Amendment?
Well, I remember watching Phil Rizzuto doing, the Yankee games in which they would always say, Major League Baseball owns this and nobody can use it, that's contractual. That's what they do. I'm not arguing for it. I'm with you, Rex. I think it would be, I think it's terrible that they're doing that. And I think that it will reflect badly on them for doing it. But I suspect it's the way that
we have a problem now with reporters who go to cover Major League Baseball, for example, tweeting, because we use Twitter a lot and covering live events. And there are significant restrictions that are being imposed by the big colleges, where, of course, sports are the major business supporting colleges, and by such entities as NASCAR trying to say, you can't do that. We own the rights to this, not you. You can't do it.
I think this is an issue that's going to end up in the Supreme Court someday, although I'm not at all sure how they would rule in
the
current
Supreme Court. I'll tell you exactly how they're going to rule. They're going to rule for business.
Well, currently they are, but it is a mess. And there's two conflicting values here. One is, yes, of course NASCAR should have the right to all their images. They make money off of that, including, as you've noted, the crashes, which are an intimate part of that sport and entertainment. On the other hand, it's also news, and that should be free. The public has a right to know about it. It should not be censored by NASCAR. So what are you going to do? And apparently Eric Deegans from Tampa has written something about this and has pointed out that, I'm sorry, that's wrong. It's actually Al Tompkins from Pointer who has written about it. And he has pointed out that journalists are now just want to avoid the whole issue, so they don't use art. They'll just cut out all the art or video from a story rather than get involved in a legal issue. And that's bad. That means the public's not being served.
As always, you're right, Rosemary.
And on that point, we'll have to let it go on the fine positive statement at the end. Join us next week, folks, for The Media Project.
I've even met a genius who swallowed...